All right, we're going to call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs, Finance Committee to order. We have a number of items on the agenda. I'm going to try and get out of here by 11:15. Today we'll be hearing, first of all, a presentation from the wheat growers who are in town. Then we'll move into budget presentations, Department of Veterans Affairs, followed by Department of Agriculture. Tomorrow we will do Board of Animal Health, and then a number of smaller bills that are starting to show up in our division. That's what's up for tomorrow. At this time, though, we'll bring the wheat growers down. Whoever's coming. Reminder, if you got cell phones, shut them off. We're friendly in here, but if they go off, it's $1 to the coffee jar. And if you answer them, it's $5 to the coffee jar. Just a reminder. Welcome to the committee, and I'll let you proceed in any manner you see fit.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Minnesota Wheat Growers, and you're correct, Mr. Chairman. It's wheat day on the hill here. Our members came down from the valley and are making visits today. I appreciate you bringing us in for this presentation. It will be very short. Our growers wanted to update you on a project they have with winter wheat breeding, and they're actually doing it in conjunction with Ducks Unlimited. And we thought your members would be interested because it's not often the ag groups work that closely with the hunting groups, and so we thought you'd like to hear about it. With me today is our president, to the far right, Brian Hest from Purley, Minnesota, just north of Moorhead on 75. We also have Blake Vandervoort from all the way from Bismarck, North Dakota with Ducks Unlimited. And so I'll turn it over to them, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Welcome. Introduce yourself again. We're taping, and that way the tape knows who you are when we listen to you later.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Zunke. It's a real pleasure to be here. My name is Brian Hest. I am president of the Minnesota Association of Wheat Growers. My farm is at Purley, Minnesota, just north of Moorhead, just southwest of Ada, Norman Clay County line. So that gives you a little perspective of where I come from. Today we're here to plant the seed, if you will. You are getting handouts from Bruce. Very quickly, I'll just go through. If you want to follow along when you get the Keeping Wheat Viable in Minnesota handout, we're seeing Minnesota acreage shift and definite trend toward more acres of soybeans, more acres of corn. And if you see the chart, and when you see the chart, you'll see where wheat is on that. It's not going in the right direction. Part of the reason here is wheat has not participated in, if you will, the research, the biotech revolution, and we are seeing at least flat yield trend lines. Current markets aside, the bottom line is we are not making progress in wheat yield. We've got a Clay County acreage trend chart in here as well, and this just kind of briefly summarizes where things are going up in my neighborhood. Same thing. Row crop acres keep increasing, and the wheat acres keep decreasing. I can say from 20 years ago when I was starting farming, wheat acres were a majority acreage crop on my farm, and today it's sharing about a third of the acres with corn and soybeans. Yield trends are also outlined here, and you see part of the reason why is we are not seeing yield increases from research in wheat. Okay, and that message comes across. What are we doing? We're trying to identify ways to stop this, ways to at least stem this. One thing we've identified is biotechnology on the research side. Another thing we're looking at is this winter wheat project. This was identified at one of our wheat summits that we held here in the state. Just a real quick overview of winter wheat. Most of the wheat grown in the state of Minnesota, the vast majority is spring wheat, planted in the spring, harvested in the fall. The problem with winter wheat in Minnesota is we have winter, and we have hard winter. We sometimes lose winter wheat if we plant it, and that's why we're here today. If we're going to make winter wheat a viable crop, and there's a lot of good reasons why we need to add this to our toolbox. We need to improve our winter wheat program, our winter wheat breeding. And what we're proposing here today is to consider a joint effort between Minnesota and North Dakota to come up with some winter wheat varieties that would not only survive the Minnesota winter, the North Dakota winter, but also would have disease packages, would have the agronomic traits that that a Minnesota wheat would require. A lot of these winter wheats that are grown currently are too tall. They don't have good disease packages, and there's just some agronomic problems with the variety. But there are so many advantages. The advantages of winter wheat, I guess I didn't touch on that. We've got some yield advantages over spring wheat. Lower inputs into winter wheat over spring wheat. Spreads out the workload on the farm. I'm all trying to be more efficient with my time. And some environmental benefits that I believe Blake will be talking about as well. Public research is critical to wheat. Chairman Junkie is I know very supportive and has been very helpful in our research efforts on spring wheat on Fusarium head blight. Most of our research is done publicly, and the St. Paul campus here in Minnesota is second to none on wheat research, and that's extremely important to us. We don't have a lot of private companies doing research in wheat. Finally, I guess I'd just like you to keep this, plant this, and our plan is to next year have a complete proposal, probably ask for some sponsorship, and to go ahead and pursue a joint winter wheat breeder with North Dakota. So with that, I'd just like to thank you. I really appreciate your time and letting us just have a few minutes here this morning. With that, I'd like to introduce Blake Vandervoort.
Welcome. Introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman Junkie, I am Blake Vandervoort. I'm a regional agronomist for Duck Unlimited out of Bismarck, North Dakota, and really appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's been about 12 years since I've had an opportunity to testify any place. Used to head a state conservation agency in North Dakota, so I've got a little experience, but it might get me in trouble, too. With that, I'll start just cover bits of the testimony that I have in writing before you a little bit in the first three or four paragraphs there. At the end of the first paragraph, I just want to indicate that we've invested 9 years now in promoting winter cereals, which is an improved nesting alternative to spring-seeded cropland. If you look under the background, the first sentence and then the last paragraph, the most successful conservation programs on agriculture-dominated landscapes are those that provide a win-win scenario for agriculture producers and wildlife. And we think our program has done that, and we'll think you'll see that as we flip over to the back page in a couple seconds here and show the acreage gains. If you look at that last paragraph in that section, recent research in Prairie Canada has revealed that there were 35 times more hatched duck nests in winter cereals than in spring-seeded cropland. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in North Dakota back in the 80s revealed similar findings. The program delivery methods that we use, and I'm just going to highlight those. You can read those at your leisure, but we've been using production research. We've been using education, technical assistance, incentives, and promotion, and we've used all five of those as strong legs to the stool that we use to deliver this program. The last paragraph there, the line graph shows the increase in winter wheat acreage in North Dakota since the inception of the winter cereal program. The increase in North Dakota's winter wheat acreage has been attributed to better management practices adopted by farmers as a result of DU's program delivery methods in cooperation with our university association and industry partners. I'd like to highlight a few of these points that I have down on background information for you, which I think points towards the Minnesota Association's request, and I'm very supportive of that. That is one of the missing links that we see is good varieties that we have available to us. We've been making good gains because of our production things, but if we want to maintain those gains or increase those gains, we're going to need better varieties that have more cold tolerance and have better disease resistance. If we look at the current increase in winter wheat acreage and yield, it's more to do to the production management changes. I've kind of alluded to that. If we flip over to the backside, the future winter wheat yield increase gains are going to need to come from better genetics. We can help more farmers increase yield with some of our management things, but to go beyond that, it's going to require better genetics. Current winter wheat programs are listed there that are in this immediate area where we draw materials from. The one thing that you'll notice in the third bullet on that back page is that the Saskatchewan winter wheat breeding program appears to be headed for closure, and that's been one of the top programs that we've drawn on for northern North Dakota and northern Minnesota in recent years. So that was a real discouraging thing we found out this summer. Winter wheat breeding program priorities in many of these provinces and states will differ from the needs in most of North Dakota and Minnesota. Example, winter hardiness, fusarium head bite, leaf spot, and rust. And if we skip down, look at environmental factors, and then you can look at the current disease or the varieties that we have, such as Jerry, which is the last release from the NDSU program before they closed it in the 90s. That variety's traits are starting to diminish in terms of disease. And then if you look at the last bullet, Ryan talked about the importance for strong straw and short straw. Our experience in our plots is that once our varieties start to yield or start to lodge, and usually with the taller varieties, that's in that 60 to 70 bushel range, that's where your yields will be capped at. We've got the potential, if we can keep the variety standing, to go up to 150 bushels in the right environment. We've actually produced 146 bushels in some of our plots. So the potential is there if the environment is there and the breeding is there and the disease management. You can see what's happened with North Dakota acreage. We're pretty proud of that. When you think about the fact that wheat acreage across the United States is going down, we actually bucked that trend and reversed it with that program. So we're pretty excited. Just in closing, then, the DU agronomists recognize the need for a winter wheat breeding program that will develop winter wheat varieties with better winter hardiness, better disease resistance, and shorter and stronger straw. If we expect winter wheat to be a consistent part of the crop rotation in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Northeast South Dakota, development of new varieties will have to be a vital part of the program. The regional climatic differences and the crop rotation differences of this region will require special emphasis on these varietal characteristics. DU is encouraged by the winter wheat breeding discussion and the foresight of the state of Minnesota, the Wheat Council, and the Association of Wheat Growers, and we look forward to working with you on this endeavor. Thank you.
Very good. A couple of things. Just general interest. Can you remind the committee and the chair, when do you drill in winter wheat, and when do you harvest it in the spring?
Good questions. We would typically be planting winter wheat. For me, it would be soybean harvest time, which helps you out. Mid-September, and Blake, pipe right in here. Typically, harvest is at least 2 to 3 weeks ahead of spring wheat harvest, so you'd probably be looking at early to mid-July, maybe later July before harvest.
That's correct. The recommended seeding days generally run from September 1 to the 20th, but we'll seed all the way to the first week of October. The advantage for wildlife is the fact that we're seeding in the fall. There's no spring disturbance, and so the nesting success goes up dramatically.
And then it's usually no-till after you harvest?
Correct.
Drilling back in with soybeans or corn or something else?
Not only has that wildlife benefit, but it has environmental benefits from soil and water quality as well.
Okay. Obviously, you're here planning, I assume, for our next budget session on a research program coordinated with North Dakota. Do you have a dollar figure yet on what the cost of that will be?
No, we do not. Blake, do you have an estimate of what?
I'm just curious if you had a rough idea or not. And then I guess more broadly, other funding sources, you know, partner at our universities and or private research. If you go down to Monsanto or some of the other breeding institutes, they look for a commitment from the growers themselves. And we haven't seen that, and you're right. I think that's what's waned in research, both at the university and the privates, is we haven't had the commitment from wheat growers and others to the extent that corn and soybeans and others have been in there. So I guess I'm asking, if you don't have dollar amounts, that's fine too, but what's the commitment from the wheat growers themselves, as well as other, I know we have Ducks Unlimited here, I assume there'll be some commitment from them. Are there other groups or other folks that are working jointly with you on this?
At this point in time, we're looking at the state of North Dakota, state of Minnesota, North Dakota Commission, Wheat Commission, and the Minnesota Wheat Council.
Okay. You have the ability to collect funds from your growers? I mean, other groups have checkoffs and other things. Do you have funding that you put forward?
Yes, the Minnesota Wheat Council, which I do not represent, but they do administer our checkoff for wheat, yes.
Okay. All right.
questions, members? Yes, Representative Magnin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. excuse me. I don't know if you saw the government report this morning, but the wheat numbers come in a lot lower than everyone else thought. So we need you to grow some more wheat. The world's looking for wheat, and I'm interested to see that you're supporting biotechnology now, and I would encourage you to continue to work with the European Union. There are some rascals to deal with. I've made many, many trips over there working on biotechnology acceptance, and I know that's going to be a concern they'll have. So if you go down that route, which I think you should look at, if you want to support the competitiveness of wheat as we go down the road, make sure you do some work over there in Europe.
Any other questions? One of the things we do and hope to continue to do is write the Ag Special, too, for the university and this committee next year, and so certainly that'll be something we'll probably have you back at that time, usually a couple days of testimony on what's needed for research, and we'll make sure you get back to remind us at that time, too, as we're putting that together, I hope, next year again. So we certainly appreciate the update and the information, and welcome you for your day on the Hill. And
thank you.
I assume you'll be in a number of members' offices during the day or out in the halls, too, so we will... We'll see you and hear from you, and we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Representative Szymanski moves the minutes of Wednesday, February 27th. Any comments on those? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. We are now going to invite our friends from Veterans Affairs to come down. Members, in your folders, obviously our charge over the next couple of weeks in this committee will be to put together a supplemental budget recommendation. Not sure how it's going yet. I suspect for committee members' information, it will probably be coordinated into one large bill eventually in Finance Committee out of all the divisions like we've done in the past. In your folders, you have a copy of the governor's bill. That will be introduced today. You also have copies of the governor's supplemental budget, all the funds sheet there, so you can see as we go through the discussions here. And then you have Department of Veterans Affairs provided a request here too. We don't have targets yet. We're going to hear that there's money suggested from the governor for this committee, but for veterans, and on the other side of the coin, there's some cuts suggested in agriculture. But we don't have our targets yet from a legislative standpoint, so we're certainly going to listen intently on the discussion here today and in future meetings. But our decisions, probably 2 weeks from today, we will lay a bill out, introduce it, and see what we want to do, and then pass it out either that day or the next, depending on what Representative Finstead and other committee members want to do. So we've got a couple weeks to kind of push this stuff around and see what direction we want to go. But we do need to start the discussions, and I welcome you to the table, and I would also remind members we are also overseeing the old Veterans Homes budget, too, which was new. We didn't put that together last year, but we certainly probably will have some questions on that also as we move forward. So, welcome, Mr. Puglisi and Mr. I never can pronounce Gill. Gill's here. It's a California name. I don't know what it is, but it's not Norwegian or Swedish, so I can't do it. But I'll let you introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation any way you see fit, and we'll interrupt with questions as we go, members, too, because I think there's specific items they'll go through. If you have questions, ask them as you go or any time. So, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner of Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. With me this morning is Gil Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner over Health Care for the Department of Veterans Affairs. And I appreciate you scheduling this today because it coincides with our Veterans Day on the Hill, As you can see, we have many of our veterans with us, veteran leadership with us, so we appreciate the opportunity today.
And certainly we welcome everyone here today and any day that we're meeting. And we know there's some activities going on, I think, over at your building at noon. I think the governor is speaking on a number of issues, including, I think, the cemetery and some other things that are happening. And I know you're going to be in a number of members' offices today, too. And so we welcome you today and any day, but especially the day to the veterans that are here. A lot of hats in the audience. We like to see that.
So do we. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're right, at 11:45, the governor will be addressing the veteran community on some of the issues, as well as doing a press conference regarding a new veterans state cemetery up there in the Duluth area. So everybody here, if you have the opportunity, you want to attend, fifth floor of the Veterans Service Building, 11:45. We'd love to see you there. And we will be visiting many of you throughout the day today, so you'll probably see my face as well as some of the veterans here today later on. What I'd like to do is just briefly touch on each of the budget requests and then take your questions. I know time is of the essence, so I'll move pretty rapidly, but please feel free to interrupt me if you want me to go into more depth. First one I'd like to start with is the State Soldiers Assistance Program.
Oh, you're on the handout you provided.
Yes, if you have that handout,
there,
it's the first page.
For those that are looking.
The State Soldier Assistance Program has been around since 1944. It's been a part of our department since we've been created. We're seeking a $2 million base adjustment. It's ongoing from the general fund. There's a request for one-time adjustment of $500,000 for this fiscal year, and that's because the program has just been doing tremendously well, and there's been a lot of emergent needs arising in the veteran community, so we're running at risk of running out of money, which is the first time I think we've ever had that experience with this program since 1944. But I think that speaks to the many needs of our veteran community right now. It's a great program in that it really is extremely responsive to the emergent needs. It helps fill the gaps of the federal programs. We have a very quick turnaround, and it really provides very true, meaningful support to our veteran families.
Now, most of the money for that, recommendations for dispersals, that come from the CVSOs, or where do you get your referrals for these dollars that go out, mainly for emergency funds, housing, food, other things?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair. All the requests for this program must come through the County Veteran Service Officers. And we structured it that way so that the veteran has to go out to their County Veteran Service Officer, get to know them, and it gives the CVSO, the County Veteran Service Officer, an opportunity to explore other possibilities at the federal level. So the CVSOs then fill out the application submitted to us, and it's for housing needs. You know, it really helps carry a veteran and their family through difficult times. If they're experiencing a temporary period of disability, and because of that, they're unable to work, we can step in, help keep them in their home, help put food on the table, clothes for their children, until they're able to get back to work. We can provide assistance for dental care, optical care. We have a special needs program that comes out of that. So if it's the middle of the winter and your water heater goes or your furnace goes out and you don't have any money, we can step in and help you with that. So it really is for very emergent needs, and it's a very responsive program.
And for members, correct me if I'm wrong, you're asked for additional $2 million on top of the $2 million that we put in last year, correct?
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct.
And you need $500,000 just to finish out this year. So you basically had $1 million a year, and you're running short this year too. And then so 1.5 additional on top of the one. So you have 2.5. So you're going 1.5 this year, 2.5 next year. Why $1 million more next year?
Is that accurate? Okay. The $500,000 for the shortfall. What we'd like to do is we want to expand the program a little bit further. In working with our County Veteran Service Officers and the veterans' requests, we're noticing we're having to say, unfortunately, no to a lot of the special needs requests. Because we're trying to budget. As much as we've been trying to budget, we're still looking at a $500,000 shortfall. We've noticed that there are a lot of other areas that we can expand into, and we've been noticing this, as a result of the calls we're getting from the link line, as well as the requests coming in from CVSOs. There's a lot of support we'd like to provide, not just to the veterans, but we'd like to provide additional support to the family members. They're suffering as well. You know, there's a lot of different types of counseling that we'd like to provide, so we'd really like to expand a little bit more. And we're seeing the need for this program continue to grow as the word is getting out there and as the CVSOs are using it more. We're getting more and more requests. So I think for this year, you know, we're looking pretty good if we can get that half a million. Next year, we know if we don't get more money, we're going to probably be back in the same situation where we're running in a deficit.
Okay.
The next budget request is for the Link Line funding. With the help of this committee last year, we created the Link Vet Line, which is a 24/7 referral and crisis intervention service. We started this new program, which has been tremendously successful, with no money. We got the software donated to us. You know, we're using existing staff currently to man the lines, do the referrals. We partnered with Crisis Connection, and we used some existing funding to do that. It's been a very successful program. You know, since August 1st, we've already had 2,500 contacts. Most of those contacts are being referred right back to their county veteran service officers so that they can get out there and explore the opportunities for benefits and services. We'd like to continue on with this program as it's been very successful. And in order to do that, we need $220,000 of ongoing funding. But as I said, it's been truly a great program. And because of this program, we're really able to identify many more needs that exist in the veteran community. And as a result of that, we're going to be talking about a case manager type program down the road.
And this program now, currently and future, is there going to be a difference? If I call at 2 in the afternoon to get your staff member, if I call at 8 at night, who do I get?
We man it with our benefits staff who are trained in veterans benefits to make those referrals from 8 to 4:30. So normal hours of operation, our benefits staff man it. After that, it goes to the Crisis Connection. We've given them training so they can make some decent referrals. But if it's not of an emergent need, a crisis, they basically say, tomorrow morning, give them a call back so they can make the proper referral. If it's a crisis, they're there to deal with it. And they're available 24/7 for crisis.
My concern is, in the future at least, my question is, do we need better staffing between, say, 4:30 and 10 o'clock? You know, most people work. They're not able to make calls during the day. A lot of people would like to talk to the, might call the line for basic information after that 4:30 period. I'm just questioning. And I don't know, I see 2,500 calls. I don't know how many of those that come in after 4:30 would be just looking for referrals for education or benefit sets or other things. And are we looking at better staffing in those hours? I suggest that later at night it's probably crisis work only. But
Mr. Chair, you're correct. Most of the calls do come between the normal hours of operation. We do have you know, phone messages as well. So when we come in, you know, a lot of people will just leave a message for us as well saying, hey, I'm interested in an education benefit or, you know, a compensation. They leave their contact. That's the first thing in the morning we'll do. But if it is a crisis, which that's the majority of the calls that are received in the evening, it rolls over to Crisis Connection. So we haven't received a lot of calls after hours for basic referrals. And those that we do, they leave a message, we get right back to them, and it seems to be working pretty well.
And then lastly, if you could break that out, staffing, training, marketing, some things, you're seeking 220 in the base, and I'm questioning, I guess, or just clarifying that sometimes program software and other things may be more of a one-time rather than an ongoing base item. So if you can break that number down, not today, but in the future, tell us what the components are that would be helpful for
us. Certainly.
All right.
Next budget request, dealing with traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder outreach and education. We're seeking one-time funding of $200,000 requested from the general fund, and we're seeking funding to promote existing post-traumatic stress disorder programs and traumatic brain injury programs for returning veterans, and even beyond that. You know, a lot of our other veterans from the Vietnam era, they may be suffering from traumatic brain injuries that haven't yet been identified. We know a lot of them do suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, so we want to promote those programs that do exist both on the state and federal level. We're looking to promote the screening for PTSD and TBIs at the federal VA medical centers and through our reintegration efforts in conjunction with the National Guard. And this is kind of a piggybacking off of a study that we did last year, Mr. Chair, where we went out there and took a look at traumatic brain injuries and PTSD and the needs or the lack of service that's available. You know, we got a good study that came back that showed that there is room for improvement, definitely across the state. We'd like to take it a step further and look at, okay, what do we need to do to implement these changes. What are those changes? What's the most effective way to go forward with that and partnering with our friends on the federal side? There's a lot of good programs out there. We do a lot of great screening. We have one of the best VA medical centers in the nation, one of four polytrauma centers in Minneapolis, who do a great job with PTSD and traumatic brain injuries. But not enough people are aware of the services and programs that are out there. And it's not always very easy for people in outstate to access those programs. So we want to take a look at possibly bringing those services and programs into the communities. And that also piggybacks off of the case management approach that we're going to talk about as well. But it's something that definitely needs to be studied a little bit more and looked at so that we can do a better job of service delivery in these two areas. Next is the phase two to the LINC vet line, which is a case management type of approach. We've been working with Representative Junkie and his staff, military affairs, and some people from the private sector on how this might work. And we have made some really great progress in some of the most recent meetings we've had. What we'd like to do, as a result, let me start with why we think this is needed. As a result of the LINC line, we've really discovered that many veterans and their family members have multiple issues. They're not just calling with one concern. They're calling and they need a lot of help. They're not working. They might be turning to drugs and alcohol. They might be suffering from mental health issues. As a result of that, they're getting close to foreclosure on their home. They're having issues with their marriage and their children, and it just continues. And it's not something that we can just make one simple referral somewhere and have it dealt with. We really need some of these families to have a case manager help them through the process, identify those issues, ensure that they're getting connected with the proper services and doing the follow-up so that we don't find them back at our doors a year or two down the road. We need to fix the problem and fix it right. So what we're proposing is some type of a case management approach where we would have people that we'd be able to have CVSOs, if they're encountering them, say, wow, this is way beyond my level of expertise. They need a case manager. Could make a referral. People from the Vet Link line could make that referral. People from our claims offices who provide representation of veterans could make that referral. What we need to do is decide who would be the case managers. Originally, we were thinking we could staff some in our department, train them, and they can provide that. But after further discussions, we realized that we don't need to expand our department. We don't need more FTE. There's a lot of services in the communities where these veterans reside that we should be working with so that they don't have to come down to the cities. We could connect them with a local provider right in their community so that they can get the services they need and the case management that they need. So we're going to further explore that, but what we'd like to see is some money, some seed money, to start going in that direction, partnering with some of these providers in the community so that we can start the process, because we really identified it as a strong need. And we're doing the best we can with trying to provide that case management and working with the County Veteran Service Officers, but it's beyond our expertise and the County Veteran Service Officers' expertise. So a lot of them, unfortunately, have fallen through the cracks. And we're just, we're putting a Band-Aid on sucking chest wounds in a lot of cases, and that's just not good enough.
And the committee members, I think this is an important piece of our puzzle this year. And there's a lot of, we've already been in discussion informally with a number of folks, nonprofits that do this in every county in our state, so that there are some backbone out there for this with different groups. And then beyond that, though, we're going to be asking, the department to not only work with case management, but also discover what's out there for service delivery over the summer, too. So again, as we come into next year, hopefully this summer and fall, and members are going to be invited to participate in this, too, if you want. We will sit down multiple times and discover what's out there for provider service delivery, whether it's financial counseling or whether it's mental health services or whether it's in-home care for veterans or what's all out there in our communities that we can basically put together in a case management type package and deliver those services county by county. And I think that's a new model that we're going to be pushing forward with based on that report that came out of the governor's task force to discover new ways to deliver services. So this is certainly a big piece in that, and but we have a lot more work to do leading up to next year.
We do. You're right, Mr. Chair. And we've been We've experienced a lot of success. You know, you may be familiar with what the Guard's been doing. They've worked with Lutheran Social Services, and they have counselors embedded in their armories throughout the metro area. So when our returning National Guard members are coming back, they have somebody right there at their armory that they can go and talk to. It's not a person from the Guard. It's not a person from the VA. They're a little bit more comfortable talking to somebody, sometimes from the private sector. And they're right there, so it's been very successful. It's a great service. If they have concerns, as soon as they get back, there's somebody there they can talk to. And it's worked very well. So we're excited to work with the private sector and bring things closer to home for our veterans. The next request is regarding our State Veterans Cemetery. We're going to be asking for some base funding. As I said, we're going to be having a press conference later today announcing the land transfer from DNR to us for another State Veterans Cemetery up along the James J. Cook Park. So we're going to be seeking some funding in the amount of $325,000. That's for the tails of the project. That's for the ongoing staffing and maintenance of the cemetery. Everything else is paid for by the federal government. The development of it, the buildings, everything. So it's a really good bang for the buck. But the only thing we're on the hook for would be the staffing and the maintenance that is required to keep that cemetery looking as good as it can. We're also looking for $75,000 in increased funding for our Little Falls Cemetery. It's a beautiful facility up there right off of Camp Ripley. We went through about a $3.7 million renovation a few years back. If you haven't been there, I strongly suggest you get up there and check it out. It's a beautiful facility, worthy of the honor of being the final resting place for many of our Minnesota veterans.
So is the 75 above and beyond the 325, or is it part of that?
That would be above and beyond.
So it's 400 total for cemetery.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Correction, Mr. Chair. I just got a shake of the head from our director. No, that would be all-inclusive.
All in the 325, so 75 is part of that. Okay, very good.
Very handy to have them with you.
Yeah, glad they came.
Yeah. Our next proposal is for MACV, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. We've partnered with MACV for many years. They are our homeless program for veterans. They do a tremendous job for our homeless community. We've gotten them some money through the state recently. We'd like to increase that amount by $250,000 because, unfortunately, they're unable to keep up with the demand of our homeless veterans, and they're having to turn away homeless veterans, which is unfortunate. They have great programs throughout the state. They do a lot of partnering with the federal government. They receive a lot of grants from private sector, federal, state. They work very closely in the communities. They have homes throughout the state where they can help homeless veterans. And they don't just house them. They really take a tough-love approach, and they really get down to the nitty-gritty with them, making sure that they educate them. They get them clean and sober if that's an issue. They help them out with getting back on their feet as far as getting jobs and education and employment. They really take a holistic approach, and the program's been very successful, and it's nationally recognized. And we're all aware of the issues that we're having with homeless veterans, which is a shame, and we'd like to do more to hopefully end that. So we're seeking $250,000 more dollars for them on an ongoing basis.
All right. I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. For those that wondered who just walked in over here, we have ninth graders, correct, from Champlin Park High School, and they're participating in a program, Minnesota Historical Society Capitol Historic Sites, Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government. They take a tour, and it's an educational program. And just so you folks know, this is the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Committee. And right now we're having a presentation by folks over at the Department of Veterans Affairs. They're asking for some additional funding this year for a number of veterans programs. So the committee is listening to what's going on, and over the next couple of weeks we have to decide what pieces of this we fund, or all of it, or none of it, or where we're going. And but it's also, if you look over here on this side of the room, you see a lot of hats. And those hats represent veterans, and it's also Veterans Day on the Hill. So it's Veterans Day, and ninth graders from Champlin Park, I think that's a nice mix. So I welcome everyone again, and glad you're here watching us. There. Now you got quite an audience, so we're expecting big things from
like an audience, though.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue.
Our next budget proposal is a state navigator, and this is in conjunction with working with Military Affairs and the National Guard. We're seeking base funding in the amount of $120,000. Request is ongoing from the general fund. The initiative is for a team of people who will coordinate state agency programs and activities to support and assist soldiers and their families during the reintegration process and beyond. And that kind of piggybacks off of all everything else that we're talking about, Mr. Chair and members, about the case managers and looking how to connect people in their community with different services. There's so much out there that state agencies provide, the federal government provides, the communities provide, the counties provide. It's very difficult for veterans to navigate all of that. So we're hoping that we can have a few people that really bring everything together from the reintegration throughout the entire process, from when you get back, you know, and you go through the reintegration process, getting your claim, getting into the health care, connecting in your community with everything that you need, all the way until you might go to one of our veterans' homes, and then beyond. So we're hopeful that we can have somebody that really connects all those pieces, takes the lead to ties all those things, brings all the players to the table, so that we can really go forward with as much efficiency as possible.
So does this hook up with Military Affairs? Obviously does their reintegration program for our Guard members. Is this a new program? We probably need to learn a little bit more about it, not today, but in preceding meetings or upcoming meetings. Is this a handoff program from that? Once they're done, is there a wall where they stop and move forward, and if there's a gap to be filled, or what?
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. There is a gap, and there is a handoff. You know, we partner very closely with the National Guard on reintegration, as well as the veteran community and the federal government does. They only go so far, and then there is that pass-off to us, and right now there is a gap where the pass-off is working okay. It could be a lot better, though. So we're looking at this position would actually be a shared position between the Guard and Veterans Affairs. So this person would represent both agencies on a lot of issues, and they would be able to make it a much more seamless transition from when you're going through integration in the Guard coming into the veteran community. And I think we've learned a lot over the past couple of years with some of these new programs that we've had regarding reintegration. There's so much out there, and there's so many programs, and there's so much goodwill. There's a lot of people out there that want to do things, and that can do things to help on the community level. We're not able to coordinate it effectively. And I think if we have somebody that can coordinate all those efforts, the veteran community will certainly benefit greatly from that.
And is this total cost $120, or is this the Veterans Affairs part of it, and National Guard Military Affairs is another part of it?
That's just Veterans Affairs part of it.
So there's another $120 over in Representative Kahn's committee?
Not sure if it's $120. $160.
$160 for yes. The Guard, $120 for you. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
The next budget request is for our Veterans Claims Office. It's a base adjustment increase of $250,000 ongoing from the general fund. It's for travel training. It's for a female veteran service officer coordinator position. And it's for staff to improve services and benefits to veterans. What our claims office does, we have two of them, one located at the Fort Snelling Federal Building and one up there at the Fargo VA. Our claims officers are there to represent veterans and their dependents in obtaining their federal benefits. It's a very complex system. It's a free service for them. And we represent close to 50% of all veterans that have powers of attorney within the state. So we have a very busy office, and we don't have enough staffing to do the job as well as we would like to. And it's a great bang for the buck because we leverage a lot of federal dollars coming back into the state. We help them get their federal education benefits, insurance benefits, compensation, pension, voc rehab, get them hooked up with their VA medical center benefits. Over $1 billion a year comes into the state in federal veterans benefits. And it's as a result of the efforts of our claims offices, as well as the claims offices that we help fund through this committee, like the Disabled American Veterans Claims Offices, the VFW, and I know we have the DAV service offices here, and they do a tremendous job as well. It's a very, very difficult field, very technical. There's a lot of errors that are made, and we need the staff that are able to do a real good job of digging deep into these files. Some of them go back from World War II with errors. If we can find these errors, we can file for a clear and unmistakable error and get retroactive payments going all the way back to 1945. It results in hundreds of thousands of dollars for these families. but we don't have adequate staffing right now to really do the necessary digging and representation that we'd like to do.
Are you seeing an uptick with returning Iraq and Afghani folks too? Is that part of the reason behind this?
Definitely, Mr. Chair and members. They're bringing back with them some baggage, unfortunately, and we need to make sure that we're getting them their claims filed quickly and that we're getting every possible federal benefit that we can. And that's what this program's all about, getting everything that we can from the federal VA process. And they do have a lot of great benefits, but some of it requires a lot of time and attention to make sure that we cut through all that red tape.
How many folks are you adding, FTEs?
This would add, I believe, is it three? Three FTE.
Okay.
And one of them would be a female veteran service coordinator. We're seeing an increase in female veterans that have combat experience, and they have unique issues, and a lot of them want to deal, rightly so, with a female. We don't have enough females in the field, so we'd like to add some female service coordinators, claims representatives, so that when we do have female veterans coming forward, if they want, they have a female that they can work with.
Okay.
The next request is for County Veteran Service Officer grants to counties and County Veteran Service Officer training coordinator. We started the enhancement grant a couple of years ago. It's been very well received. It's been well used. It's gone up each year in usage. We're hoping that this next year we'll have 87 counties that participate. It is an open, competitive grant, so they really have to do a good job of explaining to us what the use is going to be for, how this money is going to help them better serve the veterans in their county. And they've been doing a really good job with their grant applications. We'd like to increase the grant by $500,000. Right now, we're running through that money pretty quickly. Not every county is able to get money to enhance their services and programs. And as I said, it is opening competitive, and it's been quite competitive at the county level. So we'd like to expand that so that we can provide more assistance to them so that they can bring more services to their county veterans.
As members remember, a few meetings ago we did have the county veteran service officers in, and we will be hopefully developing language in our bill too to allow that group and Veterans Affairs to meet and sort through those issues. So some of this maybe is pertinent to that, some of it maybe is premature to that. We'll try and understand that as we go forward. So. But certainly we'll be talking about over the summer training and other statutory requirements and how we approach that.
Yeah, that's right. And we look forward to partnering with the legislators and the CDSOs and the veteran community on how we can better serve veterans on the county level. And, you know, this next one might be a little premature as well, but what we would like to do is have a position or two for training coordinators for the county veteran service officers. Statutorily, we're required as a department to provide ongoing training and education for the county veteran service officers. We've never received any funding or support to do that, so we use existing staff and existing budget to do that. Makes it pretty difficult, and training is paramount if they're going to provide good service to the veterans in their county. So we'd like to improve upon the education opportunities that we're providing county veteran service officers. So we're seeking some funding for positions that will be dedicated to serving the needs of our county veteran service officers, especially when it comes to the education of them. The next proposal is a higher education veterans assistance offices on campuses. This is a couple of year old program. It's been very well received. We're asking for a base adjustment of $715,000. It's ongoing from the general fund, and to increase the number of campus representatives for broader assistance statewide, and to keep the MyMilitaryEducation.org website and the accompanying toll-free call center operational. I think it says down to 3,500 contacts we had in fiscal year 06 and 07, which is just tremendous. We get a lot of very favorable comments from the students that use this program. In addition to just helping veterans that they connect with cutting through the red tape and getting all their education benefits and getting the right amount of credits for their transfers and everything, they do outreach. They work closely with the county veteran service officers. They work closely with the service community, with the veteran community. So if they encounter someone, they don't just talk about education. They make sure they're connecting with their county veteran service officer so that they can explore all the other benefits and services that are available to them. Unfortunately, we don't have enough of these campus reps to provide the type of coverage across the state that we would like to. We have a lot of schools that are voluntarily coming on board and creating these offices themselves, which is great, and that's something that this program is pushing them to do, and slowly but surely a lot of them are jumping online and doing that. But we still need more staff to oversee these operations, so we're seeking $750,000 to that. And I want to look a little, how many staff would that be? That would be 12.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it's a great program. We've received a lot of praise for it from the students, and we make a lot of great referrals as a result of that as well. The next budget request is for marketing. You've probably heard us say many times before you that, unfortunately, only about 40% of veterans receive their benefits and entitlements, and there's a reason for that. They don't know about them. We can never do enough marketing. You know, the more we get the word out there, the more veterans we'll be able to serve. And we're not talking about state dollars in a lot of cases. We're talking about the federal programs. So what we're seeking is a $100,000 base adjustment ongoing from the general fund to increase our statewide marketing and outreach. You know, we've done a tremendous job with a little amount of money over the past couple of years, but we would like to take it a step further. And we need to get the word out there, market our link to that line, market all the, you know, the fact that every county has a county veteran service officer, market all the different services that are available. Believe it or not, through our link vet line, all those calls we get, one of the questions we ask is, are you aware that you have a county veteran service officer in your county? And a majority of them aren't even aware of that. You know, so I think we really need to do a better job of raising awareness in the community that there is a CVSO right there in your county. There are benefits and services. There's a State Department of Veterans Affairs. There's all these things that exist for you so that we can better serve them. The next one is a veteran's home issue, so I'm going to let Deputy Commissioner Acevedo take that one.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning,
members of the committee. My name is Gil Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner, Veterans Health, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We're seeking one-time funding of $200,000 request from the general fund to conduct a strategic planning initiative and to conduct studies throughout the state to look at a number of things. First of all, look at the need for veterans' homes and the type of veterans' homes we want to build within the state, and also the strategic direction that we want to head as an agency. We also are in line with the Governor's Long-Term Care Commission that identified that the agency needed to do more of a strategic planning, strategic direction on how we're going to be conducting business as a long-term care or a veterans home in the future.
And just to that, $200,000, is that to hire someone outside the department for this planning study, or is it what specifically is the money?
Mr. Chair, the money is to identify a number of things, to identify consultants to go out and look at the state as a whole and the population of where we would best place a veteran's home and the need, but also to have consultants available for us as well as for the agency to build our strategic plans for the future. So it's not just to hire a person, but also to conduct the studies to go throughout the state.
Why we got you going, looking at the budget last year, members, I glanced at the old Veterans Homes Board budget, which now we have, and it's part of under Veterans Affairs. One of the items in there was a line items for a board of directors budget in each year, $3.8 million for the 2 years. There's no longer a board of directors, so I'm wondering what became of that budget item and that line and where that money migrated to, and or is it earmarked for something else? If you don't have that today, I'd like an update on that.
Okay, I can bring an update to you.
Sure. Okay, I'd like an update on those line items, because it was 1.897 in 08, 1.960 in 09, and it was strictly a line item for the board of directors. And then there was a $2 million per year repair and betterment line item, and I wondered if that got funded, A, and if it did, an update on what that money is being utilized for, too. Again, as we look at bonding bills now with the health and safety items and some of the other things, and I'm just wondering how they mesh together too. So if you can bring me that sometime in the next few days, the committee will share that. So,
Mr. Chair, I can comment a little bit on the money for the board of directors, and we'll get you more information on that. You know, that was to support the efforts of all the homes, and they worked for the board, which is no longer in existence. So that staffing that supported the IT, the finance, the HR, the quality assurance, all those things, those positions still exist. Those have been transferred over to the Department of Veterans Affairs. So there's still a need for that funding to pay for those salaries.
Now the question is too, and I realize it didn't happen this year, but I believe July 1st we will officially, the second year of the biennium, mesh the budgets together within the department. So at that time, I guess what we need to understand going forward, I understand the positions exist now. I assume there's going to be some efficiencies. Again, we point to Christine over here. We only need one legislative liaison, perhaps only one finance director. So I guess that's what we're trying to discover with this money. What efficiencies might we be seeing in your budget, which is what we expect, going into the second year of the biennium? So your comments are well taken. I know everyone's still there today, but July 1st, I think, is the magical day we're looking for.
And Mr. Chair and members, part of the study money would be to look at that as well. How do we create those efficiencies, partnering with MAD in the Department of Administration, helping us come together? You know, it's a lot more difficult than any of us imagined, bringing the homes and all their staff into the Department of Veterans Affairs, how all the IT meshes, the finance, the HR. So it's pretty complex, so we're hoping to use some of that to take a good look at how do we meld ourselves better together, how do we create those efficiencies.
Questions from members? Representative Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And I asked this question this morning in another committee, and I'll ask it in the Ag, or the Chair can ask it as well. But I'd like, when there are federal grants that are received, or you have a state, there's a state indirect cost, and there's an agency indirect cost that comes in on dedicated dollars, and you don't have to answer this right now, but I'd like that information on what your percent is on the state indirect cost and the agency indirect cost. And then if I could get the commissioner's plan employees, the salaries, travel, and any bonuses as well, line item.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we'll get that information for you.
Other questions, comments? Seeing none, we thank you for that initial. We'll probably be having you back a couple of times, or at least meeting outside the room and probably here with additional questions. But I think it's a good overview of what's being laid out, members, and now we have to start sorting through how we utilize this request. And again, well, we don't know what we're going to get yet from the House and the Senate on target. So,
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for having us today. We appreciate it. We'll be seeing you probably throughout the day. Thank you.
Thank you. Department of Agriculture. We'll give everyone a minute. Clear here. Yeah, you sure do know how to clear a room. Huh?
It's biting us having some fun.
I know. It's terrible, isn't it? All right. Do we have any handouts from you? Anything? Well, members, we're going to have to look it up then. Let's see.
Mr. Chair.
What page are we? Page 28 of 43 in your governor's supplemental. We see the Department of Agriculture. Introduce yourself. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Quinn King with the Department of Agriculture, and I'm here to talk about our supplemental budget item, single item, which the governor's budget includes a $102,000 reduction to the Department of Agriculture in fiscal year 2009. This simply reduces funding for administrative services, which includes funding for the commissioner's office, IT, human resources, and our finance and budget section. That's really all there is to say.
Well, I know that's all there is. Here's my question right off the start. The Agriculture Department General Fund, fiscal year 08, current budget, $23,980,000. Non-general fund, ag accounts and others, $31,620. 102, we've been asked, both in the House and the Senate, to come up with ideas on 3%. I know the governor has asked agencies to do that, too. That's nowhere near 3% for the ag department. So I guess my question is, where did this come from? Why is the ag department being treated different than the other departments? I'm just looking for an explanation. That's a pretty small amount based on what other agencies have been asked to do, and frankly, based on what we have been asked to do. If we're not going to increase revenues, we've got a 3 or 4% cut coming somewhere. It's not going to be easy. It's something we all have to talk about, but that's well below that.
Mr. Chair, each of the agencies in the administration was treated a little bit differently. We were all asked to give some ideas, and some of those, and the governor incorporated certain ideas into his budget, and what you see is reflected here, the items that he chose to go forward with.
So did you do the exercise for any more than this at the time? Because I know there were requests out there.
We gave the governor several options for
My question is this. If we ask you for your recommendations for a higher number than that, are you going to work with us and provide that, or are you leaving it up to our discretion to take care of business the way we see fit?
We would certainly be happy to comment on any suggestions that you have, respond to any questions that you have about the budget. As far as the agency's budget, this is our supplemental budget request that's in the governor's.
I understand that, but again, from a legislative standpoint, and the members understand what I'm saying, if you're just going to comment on what we're doing, then we will be doing it. So if you're willing to work with us and come to committee and tell us, okay, if we're moving towards a 3 or 4%, here's be the least detrimental to us, we're happy to listen to that too. But commenting, we're putting a bill together in 2 weeks, so commenting on what we do may not get too far. I'm just laying that out. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm somewhat shocked that you, you've been asking for this for years, that the smaller Department of Ag is treated fairly when it comes to the budget tightening. So I'm happy to see the governor put out a proposal that treated the ag area very decently. With all due respect, I don't know who's asking you to do a 3 or 4%. I assume it's your leadership.
It's our fiscal people.
All right. Well, if it's your leadership, then I guess that would be on your shoulders, not the department, because the governor has proposed what he wanted in his Department of Ag budget. So the 3 or 4% that you're talking about, and again, with all due respect, I mean, that's essentially then on your leadership's shoulders with the Speaker's office. So I would say the department will most likely do what they've always done in the past, and that's respond to they put out their proposal. Now it's our job to put out ours and then have them respond to what they can and can't live with what we've put out there and move forward. But I guess I'm happy to see finally we have a budget shortfall, and the Department of Ag is not, from my perspective, unfairly treated in the way that the governor's budget has been presented. So I think we have only better places to get to with your leadership.
Well, and Representative Finstead, I do agree. As people remember, we had $2.5 billion of deficit, and that was about a 14% across the board cut if we would have done it. And you're right, ag ended up with a 28% cut that year, so way more than what I thought was fair if we were doing across the board budgeting as far as the deficit goes. So, but again, this year we've been asked to do the exercise. I don't know where we're going to end up because I don't have targets yet. So we do need to do the exercise as a committee, I would hope, to understand where we can find some efficiencies or reduce some overhead or waylay some monies that are out there in the future. There's a lot of grant dollars, there's a lot of one-time monies that are involved that maybe haven't been earmarked or utilized yet either, and which could easily cover the small general fund budget that we're looking at. So we're just keeping all the lines open this point in time because as a finance committee, that's what we're charged to do is come up with a legislative budget in response to the administration's budget also. Questions from anyone? All right. Tomorrow we will have the Animal Board of Health, and we'll look at, there's a packet in here, members, on some grants. Mr. Reinholtz is going to do a spreadsheet. I don't know if he can get at it yet or not, but I did put the packet in there, and I'd ask staff to hang on to that packet. We'll talk about some of that tomorrow, because Board of Animal Health is involved in that, too. So, and then we have a few little bills. Anything else?
Put it in your save folder.
Put it in your save folder. If you want to save any of this, they'll keep it. With that, meeting adjourned.